Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Of course, we Zoom on Sunday afternoon. Every time I get our Rethink the Week group together, I keep thinking, it's got to be a year. It can't be 7 days. It's got to be a year. We're packing too much calamity into such a short amount of time. But speaking of calamity, we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified before the impeachment hearings of 2019. I mentioned to Ken just before the show that I gotta find Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. I would love to talk to him now. I would love to have him sort of assess what he's seen and how our country has sort of begun to, in some ways, devolve around him. Anyway, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us for our Rethink the Week is three great talkers. Val Endres is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. And our poverty expert and guy at the Carsey Institute at UNH Manchester is Stephen Pinpair. All three of you actually are so perfect because when you think about it, political communications, I don't know who's talking to Donald Trump, but he's having some real problems. I think he really is sort of coming apart. And then, of course, Stephen Pinpair, all the underpinnings of Black Lives Matter and what we're seeing with Defund the Police has to deal with this social underpinning of society where we have disinvested in education and disinvested in healthcare and disinvested in housing. And the people that have been harmed the most have been people of color. And then, of course, Dean Spiliotis, we have to talk about presidential stuff, just because the part of the reason why Donald Trump is, I think, flailing is that he's terrified because he's noticing that in some swing states, it doesn't look so good. Anyway, before we begin this, so I'm on Twitter and I see this tweet and it says, every white person in America should see this. And it only lasts 37 seconds, everyone. We're gonna try to play it so you can hear it because I want you to hear her voice. It is the voice of Jane Elliott. Jane Elliott is an anti-racism activist. She is best known for what she did right after the murder of Martin Luther King. She was teaching in a little elementary school in Iowa, and she did something called Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes. It was an exercise where she attributed all the good things, strength, smarts, intellectual ability, everything possible to people of brown eyes, but then people with blue eyes. Ah, they were weak, they were not so smart, they were this. And of course, let's remember everyone, she was doing this in Iowa. I bet you 98.9% of the room had blue eyes. And from there, she teaches black versus white. But this is the 37 seconds that I saw just yesterday. Jane Elliott speaking to a room of all white folks.
As this society in general treats our citizens, our black citizens, if you as a white person would be happy to receive the same treatment that our black citizens do in this society, please stand. You didn't understand the directions. If you white folks want to be treated the way blacks are in this society, stand. Nobody's standing here. That says very plainly that you know what's happening. You know you don't want it for you. I want to know why you're so willing to accept it or to allow it to happen for others. as this society in general treats our citizens, our black citizens.
That was 37 seconds of Jane Elliott speaking in a room of all white people. Let me remind you again, she says, as this society in general treats our black citizens, would you as a white citizen want to be treated the same? She said, if so, please stand up. And you have to look at the room because everybody is looking at each other and they're all like miserable and uncomfortable. And then she says, okay, maybe you didn't understand me. So she repeats the question, which makes it worse, okay? Because now you can just feel the room so uncomfortable. And she says, that says, you know what is happening. And now the question is, if you know what is happening and you don't want it to happen to you, why have you been willing to let it happen to them? Dean Spiliotis, I saw that and I replayed it and I replayed it. And I thought it was one of the most powerful 37 seconds of my entire life, because never before have I seen someone nail it and make everyone get it. And I said to Val and to Stephen, I want to play it at the Daughters of the American Confederacy. I want to play it in every evangelical church. I want to play it in Mississippi. I want to play it in Alabama. I want to play it before the GOP at their next Con or whatever they have. It is such a powerful statement about the fact that we all know, but it has become acceptable to think that it's okay for you to have and them to have not.
Yeah, it was a very powerful moment. You know, I think it speaks to the idea that you may be aware that racism exists. It may make you very uncomfortable, as you could hear in that clip. But I think what's happening now in the current circumstances, it's hard to avoid it in the sense that we're all seeing it in real time on cell phone video. We've seen it on digital clips now year after year, the last 10 years or so, just one episode after the next, confronting us on film. They're really, with the current example with George Floyd, you can't turn away from it. It's a lot easier in your daily life to kind of be aware of it, but if you don't have to confront it directly, it's not something that perhaps you spend as much time thinking about as you might otherwise. And I think what we're seeing now in the current situation is that even people who are who have been aware of the structural inequalities, racism, et cetera, for years, and maybe kind of turn away and focus on other things in their own lives, couldn't turn away from that video. And I think that's really been driving a lot of the anger, but it's been building over a number of years.
So Stephen, you talk and teach a lot about poverty and homelessness and so many of these issues. We know what's going on in black schools in urban America. We know about the fact that when you have 75% of the kids going to school on the breakfast program and the lunch program and the dinner program, something's not happening. It's called food at home. We know when you learn about the pandemic and that the effect of the pandemic is overwhelmingly lethal within the black and Hispanic community. We know when it comes to things like how many people are warehoused in prison. There was a wonderful Christian Science Monitor article where a gentleman walked into him, this is from maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and it was a group of African Americans. And he basically said, I want you to see the person sitting next to you, the person sitting in front of you, the person sitting on the side, the person sitting on the, at least one of you, if not two of you, will be in prison by the time you're 27. I mean, it was like, you don't say that in a white room. You say that in a black room. But it's not like there hasn't been a case built. It's not like we all don't have some awareness of this. I'm just trying to figure out, is it because of the 8 minutes and 46 second tape? Or is it because Trump, in a lot of ways, has created the level of anxiety and racism and inequity so that we're all kind of conscious of it because he preaches it, and then we see real death on tape based on so much of what he talks about.
So I think it's worth us digging into the why now question, because I think it's an important one and I think it's a hard one. I think there's one other thing to say before that, and that is that the question that Elliott did not ask her audience is, What is it in terms of the benefits that you accrue from this system of racial hierarchy that you are willing to surrender in order to create a more equitable political society, right? This is also not new, right? I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois in the late 19th century talked about the psychological wage of whiteness, right? The ways in which by creating these elaborate hierarchies of white supremacy built into every aspect of the United States, that accrues benefits to whites and has continued to accrue benefits to whites throughout our entire history, right? So we've sort of written this deeply into every institution in which we interact, and it is written so deeply that ordinarily those of us who benefit from those systems of racial hierarchy and oppression find them invisible, right? We don't see them. We don't, I think it's part of why people react when people talk about, we need to talk about abolishing the police, right? Sort of white Americans react with horror. It's like, well, no, wait a minute, right? Think about what your life is. You by and large lead a life without police. You already experience it, right? This is not new. It's the fact that we're starting to confront the fact, maybe, now in a way more deeply than we have in the past, confront the reality that we are and continue to be an apartheid society. We were formally apartheid up until 1965 with the 64 and 65 with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. We have continued to be de facto apartheid until then. I'll stop there, but I do think we should circle around to the make sense as to what's happening at the moment.
And I think, Val, what is so shocking to people is that they think, well, it's the law. It must be race neutral. It's the law. And then you find out that when you actually look at the consequence of this race neutral law, it ain't race neutral. I mean, one of my absolute favorite books by, I think it's Rothstein, is called The Color of Law. I mean, in some ways, The Color of Law is even more obnoxious because it didn't even try to look race neutral. I mean, in a lot of ways, so much of what we do is packaged in such a way that unless you're familiar not only with the consequences, but why they're writing it the way they are, I mean, it explains things like redlining, you know, and it was justified. I mean, think about people that served in World War II and came home and thought because they were veterans, whether they were black or white, they would be treated the same. And then you find out that if you were a white veteran, you were treated differently than a black veteran, but yet it wasn't called that. It wasn't called the white veterans law. It was called the veterans law. I mean, I think part of it is not only what Stephen has said, which is all of a sudden you've had such a benefit, but the part of the benefit, Val, is that we have whitewashed our history books. We have not been willing to teach what's happening because then it would undermine the benefit. And what's happening with the videos, Dean Spiliotis, and what's happening now with what we're seeing and what's happening, frankly, now with social media, is that it's really getting hard to hide it. It's getting hard to make it disappear because now it's punching its way out everywhere.
Well, you know, Arnie, history books have been rewritten and we are educated. You know, I'm thinking back nearly a decade ago, the book, The New Jim Crow, that talked about mass incarceration. And that was a bestseller. But that didn't change the prison system. So I think that we have to look at the fact that alterations in our law get us nowhere. So people are talking about defunding the police, but the supports for white privilege are really baked into society. And so it takes, first of all, people of color and diverse people in positions of power to dismantle that white privilege. And we're not talking about tweaking a law here and there. We're talking about genuine sacrifice of white privilege. And you know, that is much more difficult than saying I'm a good ally and let me go out and march.
You're talking about sacrifice. You know what this reminds me of? So Dean Spiliotis, remember the oil the oil crisis when Jimmy Carter was president. And the worst thing Jimmy Carter did was put on a cardigan. Because what he told the American people is, you're going to have to turn the thermostat down. You're going to have to be cooler. Oh, my God. I'm like, oh, no, Jimmy. You're asking them to be cooler. You're asking them to sacrifice their warm house. So instead of it being 74, it should be 67. I mean, in a lot of ways, we've never developed, at least the white community, has never developed the sacrifice muscle and never developed that idea. And so what you are saying is absolutely true, Val. But as someone said the other day, when they're talking about defunding the police and all the other rhetoric, it's that what we need to do is we need to solve problems, not send in the cops. That's what needs to happen. We're sending in the cops as if it solves a problem. And all the cops are doing is they're blanketing the problem. They're camouflaging the problem. They're intensifying the problem. But they're not solving the problem, Val.
But Arnie, you know, the thing is, I agree with you, but who gets to solve the problem? That's where white privilege comes into play, right? Because whites hold positions of power. So from their perspective, they can solve the problem without too much sacrifice. And what it really takes is the people who suffer the most for them to have a seat at the table, not only to have a seat at the table, but to own the table to solve the problem.
So Dean, when we went into Afghanistan, one of the first things George Bush insisted upon was that if you're gonna have a democracy in Afghanistan, at least, what is it, 50% of the electorate and people serving in the Afghanistan parliament or whatever should be women. And I'm thinking, really? Have you noticed your Congress recently? I mean, it's like we say one thing and we deliver exactly the opposite. When we thought we wanted to expand opportunity, we created things like affirmative action, all right? And affirmative action has cut in an interesting way. I don't know how much it has benefited people of color. It has definitely benefited women. Okay, affirmative action had a really positive effect on women. How do we assign people, give people a seat on the table, at the table, when we have seen a pattern in practice now of gerrymandering, of disenfranchisement, of redlining, of all these things, all these structures, these walls that have been built before Donald Trump was even working on the wall on the Mexican border? We have built so many walls that the idea of saying they need to own it, I'm just trying to figure out how do we get them over the wall?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot the last couple of days. I don't have an easy answer for that. I think it's a very complicated problem in the current, for any political environment, but certainly in the current political environment, you know, particularly the last couple of days where the defund the police slogan has gotten increasing visibility, more high profile discussion. You can already see it becoming highly politicized. I think Republicans or Trump supporters see it as an easy opportunity to kind of paint progressives as kind of extremists. You're gonna do away with police. Is that realistic? What does it mean to defund the police? Are you talking about just giving them less money? Are you talking about abolishing them? Are you talking about demilitarization? It means a lot of different things to different people. And, you know, the likelihood, I mean, I think the Democrats in the Congress are going to try to piece together some legislation. My guess is it'll likely go nowhere. And so I think the reality is right now, if this, to the extent that this happens, or that there are changes in police departments, whether it's defunding or reducing funding or demilitarizing, you know, a lot of that is going to happen at the state and local level. It's going to be a function of grassroots political organizing and electoral politics. Gerrymandering is certainly yet another obstacle. But barring some huge sea change at the federal level, I don't see how this is going to happen in a kind of coherent, overarching national framework. It's going to be fits and starts. It's going to be local. It's going to be states. It's going to vary from region of the country to region of the country. You know, defund the police is kind of a very compact slogan, but it's just a very complex set of ideas. So, so you know, just trying to think through what that means and how you'd move forward on that. We're going to be discussing this for a while.
I think one of the most shocking things for me was to start looking around and seeing what the size of the line item is in different cities that funds the cops. When you see line items of 47%, of 52%, of 59%, I mean, you're going, this is not possible. They have to do everything at the city level. They have to put out the fire. They have to deal with the healthcare. They have to deal with the education. They have to deal, and you're seeing that 50% of the city budget is going to the police. I mean, if anything, that makes it easier to actually say the word defund the police. You're not basically saying strip them to zero, but you're saying there's got to be something wrong when, Stephen, it's 47% of the city's budget. That's just, that's unconscionable.
You know, and I think Dean's point is well taken, that we're unlike, the first place we're going to see movement on this is not going to be at the national level.
Oh, cool.
But yesterday, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti said that he is reevaluating his city's police budget this morning. I'm trying to think of what the word I want to use is to describe Bill de Blasio. Let's just use the word mayor for the moment. Bill de Blasio of New York City, my former home, has announced that he is encouraging the council to reexamine city budgets. There are folks who have been looking at various kinds of decarceration in really sort of serious policy specific terms for the better part of a decade. This is, of course, stuff that Angela Davis has been talking about, right, for decades and decades and decades and decades. She started talking about this in the 60s and 70s before the contemporary era of mass incarceration and before the contemporary period of the aggressive militarization of local police forces. And this, of course, began under the Democrats, right? Bill Clinton, yep. This was sort of by the mid-90s, we enacted a series of bills at the national level that sort of in complicated kinds of way funnel both actual military equipment and funding to buy military equipment to local police forces, which is why you see Podunk City A with a tank and guys with rocket launchers and full military gear. And to paraphrase, right, sort of Anton Chekhov, who said, if you see a gun on the wall in the first act of a play, it's got to be fired in the third. If you start shoveling military equipment to local police forces, they will eventually use them and start to act like military forces. That's a lot of what we were seeing. And that can be something we do at the federal level relatively easily, at least cut off.
Okay, so I've been an environmental activist, Al, for a while. And one of the things that we learned early on is that we probably couldn't get the feds to change something. But if we started making waves and creating pockets of change on the environmental level in different states, in different cities, eventually people would go, I can't take it anymore. We got to do it at the national level. And I think that Stephen is absolutely right. You are going to see cities around the country. You are going to see Houston respond, San Francisco respond, all these places respond. And eventually, it will ultimately trickle up. I do think the election of 2020 matters incredibly more so now than I've ever thought in my life. But let me tell you what I think Donald Trump will do. I predict this. Write down the date, everyone. See how Donald Trump has been reluctant to bail out the cities and states? So here's what Donald Trump will do. I'll bail out your police department. You see, what Donald Trump will do is he'll deliver cash, but he'll deliver cash to where he wants to deliver it. And this, in a way, is reinforcing what we saw happen, I believe it was in Wisconsin, where the governor of Wisconsin divided the unions up. So the teachers' unions were over here and the police unions were over there. What Donald Trump is going to do is sort of speak to his base, say, look, I'm sending you money. Of course, you're so frightened by what you're seeing. I'm going to send in money and I'm going to fund your police. I'm going to send them more military equipment, Stephen Pimper. And I think that's what is so interesting about this moment is that I think we really need to educate the population about the fact that right now 50% of your budget is already going to the cops. Look what Donald Trump wants to do. Therefore, when you talk about defunding, you're not just saying, oh, these poor cops. You're saying, oh my God, what about all the other things that have been, you know, starved as a result of this?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And hopefully we can put an end to the Trump era and we can start looking at the militarization of the police force much more seriously. You know, one of the things that I found quite interesting from the charts that talk about the percentage of the budget, and I just noticed this at a glance, and I'm not quite sure what the research says, But those cities with a high diverse population happen to have more money for public safety. And I think there's probably just a real dangerous correlation there that we've got to unpack. And so, you know, this at its roots is talking about what do we mean by public safety? What are the public, or what are the police protecting us from?
And who is the public when we talk about the public, right?
Right. Yes, who is the public? I'm absolutely right. You know, again, I'm looking at this, and I think you saw the same graph I did, which is a frightening correlation when you begin to see it. And at the same time, you know, you mentioned Angela Davis. We had Alex Vitale on from Brooklyn College, who wrote the book about the police. He's been talking about this.
Spectacular book.
And see, this is the one I want you to bring to Rhode Island College, Val. He's really unbelievable. But again, I think the thing that absolutely blew my head was Dean. He said, why do you have police in schools when what you need are more social workers, right? And then he said, why do you send the cops to an overdose when what you need is a drug counselor? Why do you say, I mean, it's like when you, and I think in the end, it's not only about defunding the police or ending the police. You are setting the police up to fail. You are setting them up to fail, Dean, because they don't have those skills. The only skills they have is book them, arrest them, and send them to jail. And all that does is-
Well, or assault them and kill them.
Exactly. All right, let's go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. It is our Rethink the Week.
Dancing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let us rejoicing rise, half the listening skies, let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Stony the road
one. Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is our Rethink the Week. We have Val Endres from Rhode Island College. We have Stephen Pimper from the Carsey Institute in UNH. And we have Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. You mentioned, Stephen, during the break that you want to still kind of unpack what does this moment mean. It's gone on for such an incredibly long time. And I do have to say something, since we're from, two of us are from New Hampshire. Oh, actually, all of us are, except for you. I'm so sorry, Val. But anyway, I was outside of Concord, New Hampshire yesterday, which was Saturday. And they probably had the largest march they've ever had. It was organized, Stephen, by high school students at Concord High School. And there were thousands, not hundreds, thousands. They were talking about 10,000 marching in Washington. We had close to, I think, 3,000 in Concord, New Hampshire. And not only has it been 2 weeks, and we're talking about virtually white New Hampshire, all right, and white Concord, where you saw 3,000 people being organized by young high school students, and they came out in droves. And as I looked at this crowd, I thought back to 1985, when Martin Luther King's birthday came before the New Hampshire legislature for us to adopt it as a holiday. Out of 400 legislators, only 60 agreed to it. Out of 400. And then I recalled that in 1999, New Hampshire became the last state in the nation to embrace Martin Luther King's birthday. 50th, all right? But one of the things that was interesting about the 1999 embrace of MLK Day was that it was really part of a children's crusade, that kids were petitioning and marching and writing their legislators to recognize Martin Luther King. And then on Saturday, I watched thousands of people come together to recognize these amazing moments of the week, and to speak about Black Lives Matter, and to demand change now. And once again, it was high school kids that organized it. So let's talk a little bit about what's been happening. But I think what is so remarkable is not only is it happening, and every race is showing up, and every demographic is showing up, and I'm seeing a level of engagement with young people where I think they're now realizing their power and their voice. Stephen?
As you say, there's a lot to unpack. It's one of the things that perennially has vexed scholars who study social movements is the effort to figure out, right, where they come from. Why do they happen at one particular moment and not another particular moment? And then which are the ones that go on to actually have sustained effect in altering public policy? And then which are the ones that don't, right? And how do we trace out those effects? And, you know, sort of some of the smartest people on the planet who study this their entire lives kind of throw up their hands and say, yeah, not entirely sure, right? What we do know is that, or what I think I know, let me say that differently, is that there is no sustained, meaningful, progressive change that you can point to in American history that does not have at its heart a social movement, mass disruptive protest, right? Now, we've got lots and lots of protests that do not lead to, right, that sustained change. So it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. So the question is what's going on right now? Is this Selma or Stonewall, or is it the women's marches after the inauguration of Trump, right? Sort of where is this going to go? And of course, none of us here know what's going to happen in the future. Here's what I think makes this a little bit different and gives me hope. Right. One is absolutely the scale and scope of it. Right. It may well turn out to be the largest sustained protest, not only in U.S. history, but in world history. Right. If you see what's going on around the globe. Right. Part of what makes it possible, of course, is, ironically enough, the pandemic itself, exactly. Right? With a formal 20% unemployment rate, lots of other people working from home, suddenly all sorts of people are available for public protest who otherwise wouldn't be, right? And it's on top of being cooped up for 2 or 3 months in a state of perennially heightened anxiety, right? So you've got people already existing in this heightened state, And of course, layer on top of that, the Trump presidency and Trump himself, right? And this sort of creeping recognition of not just authoritarian tendencies, which we've known, but an increased at least effort to exert it, right? The one other thing I want to throw on top of that is that because it's an election year, right? It creates the possibility, and the election is a long way off, right? But it creates the possibility that we have massive turnout and large-scale Democratic victories that give us a Democratic president, Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate. With this movement behind that, I would expect that Congress to enact, or try to enact anyway, fairly radical legislation. This creates a space, potentially, that otherwise would not exist.
So Dean, as I'm listening to him, and so I'm thinking the 20% unemployment, and then of course those new unemployment numbers that came out that Donald Trump is trumpeting, and of course we find out that they made a slight mistake, and they're really 3%.
But sorry, just don't the BLS are, if the BLS were being manipulated by the Trump administration, we would have heard about it.
Okay,
right.
No.
They were really upfront.
They were really upfront in the document about how hard it's been for them.
No, I understand. But Stephen, of all the times to make a mistake, it's kind of like really tragic just because it looked like the biggest increase ever. But you're
right. Yeah, but you try to get unemployment numbers during a pandemic.
Right. All right. So let me go back to where I'm going though. And Dean, so people are going back to work. So here's the story about going back to work. Less hours, more vulnerability, less tips. I mean, it's like all the things that, you know, work isn't a refuge. Work is now less of everything. So even if you're back to work, you're asking yourself, how do I survive back to work? So while the numbers look better, and while we're trying to crawl back after being shut down for so long, not only do you see what's going on in the streets, not only do you see the 8 minutes and 47 seconds of, you know, someone's knee on George Floyd's neck. I mean, I don't know about you, but did you see what MSNBC did, Dean? MSNBC had a clock on the TV and they played nothing but the 8 minutes and 47 or 49 seconds, nothing. You just watched 1 minute, 1 minute one, 1 minute two. It was unbelievable how long it took to get to that. So you're looking—
Yesterday's rally in Concord, Arnie, did the same thing, except during the 8 minutes and 47 seconds, somebody read the name of one of the black people who was murdered by police very slowly, time in between. And it was just shocking how long it took.
Right.
Seemed like forever.
Forever, exactly. So I'm listening to what Stephen is saying, but I'm also looking at the numbers getting a little bit better, but then I'm looking at what people are returning to. You know, it's ironic in some ways because the people who can work from home have nothing to worry about in a lot of ways. They've had sort of the life of Riley. You know, they can still work at home. They can shelter in place. Their incomes kept coming in. They may actually be staying at home forever. Who knows? Because they're able to do this given. But those that were forced to leave and then come back are finding out that the return to work is not a celebration. It's actually now perhaps an even greater struggle, Dean.
Yeah, there's no denying that back to work in the current context is not simply back to work, and we don't really know what the long-term consequences are going to be in terms of layoffs, in terms of, you know, new limitations on how people do business, on capacity for either, you know, events and restaurants and all kinds of retail businesses, and the impact that that's going to have the hospitality industry, manufacturing, on and on and on. I mean, the ripple effects are quite remarkable. And, you know, the whole discussion about the new economic numbers and was it an honest confusion over how to categorize certain workers. And we're still, even under best case scenario, we're still talking about, was it 13 or almost 14%. Unemployment, which is pretty amazing. And we just don't know exactly what the economic recovery is going to look like. And I think to get to Stephen's earlier point, I mean, he did a good job of talking about all the layers upon layers of, you know, the pandemic, the huge impact on the economy, sort of history of systemic racism and structural inequality, the way in which technology has now made it increasingly difficult for us to look away from a lot of these injustices, even if that's what we would do under other circumstances. And then on top of that, the intensity of the George Floyd moment, on top of all that, almost just kind of the final light that led to the whole conflagration. And there is a political opportunity here. I think you're seeing the involvement of youth, I think, is very interesting and encouraging. I think technology has a lot to do with that. I see how a lot of my students kind of interact and how they organize and how they engage. And it called to my mind some research I read a little while ago about how increasingly young adults, college students, don't really identify political parties as the means through which they're going to enact social change. They use other kinds of organizations and other kinds of networks, social networks, et cetera. I think we're seeing that. My kind of listening in to what younger activists were saying over the last couple of weeks, so much of it is driven by the social media platforms. I mean, that's how they conceptualize of what needs to be done and how you move things forward. But there's still a lot. We still have a lot of unknowns out there about, can this be sustained through November?
Right.
You know, how will the economy dovetail with that or not? And then, you know, what things will look like in terms of the pandemic in the fall.
So I said to someone the other day, Val, is this a rock the boat moment or a tipping point? And this is definitely the boat's being rocked, but there's a difference between that and the tipping point. And I go back to the decision of the New York Times to run an op-ed by Tom Cotton. Oh, my frickin', you know what? I'm like, and where he's supporting the idea of the use of the military. And what I think is phenomenal is how many people in the military have stepped up and sort of not just slapped down Donald Trump, but slapped down Tom Cotton. But it scares me in a lot of ways because I am trying to figure out, you teach political communications. I'm thinking about journalism and I'm thinking about what is the responsibility of papers like the New York Times and how do you celebrate the diversity of voices, which you have a responsibility to do, that there are different perspectives, but also understand the op-ed real estate, which is so precious and so powerful, there also has to be some kind of a fiduciary responsibility to publishing. So as someone who's trying to figure out how do journalists navigate this, because they want to cover it. And what we've seen, despite all the horrific events of the last couple of weeks, is there is still 37% of Americans that are supporting everything coming out of Donald Trump. You can't ignore them, Val. That is part of who we are. I may not like it. I may be disgusted with it. But how do we understand that that is a huge segment of our population? And frankly, unfortunately, Tom Cotton is, with Donald Trump in hand, is massaging that base, even as Mattis and so many others are trying to say, no, 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 please revisit your constitution. I mean, if you've ever read it. But I am still trying to figure out how to deal with the 37%, because that is an enormous chunk of the population, and they will be there even after the election.
Well, I have a couple of things to say about editorial responsibilities. I did a program once with national journalists that were on the left side of the spectrum and some that were on the right side of the spectrum. And they agreed on a number of points. And one of their points was that a liberal journalist will choose to report on different things than a conservative journalist will. But the point of agreement was on fact-checking. And that's where the New York Times was blatantly wrong. And in that article that you have for your listeners to read, they talk about that whole notion that they did not fact-check the senator. And so that ends up being a huge issue. And the other issue that I think is even more problematic is with the whole notion about social media. We move from one topic to another at lightning speed. And before, when we, in the pandemic, it's almost as if the pandemic is over because they're no longer doing counts on the pandemic. They're barely mentioning it anymore, and they have moved on to the issue at hand. And it's a righteous issue, and they need to talk about it. But what happens when something else comes up? And that's where Donald Trump comes into play, because he knows how to play the media with outrageous behavior and take the attention away. So what I worry, I mean, I agree with both Stephen and Dean about the notion about a youth-led movement. I think the LGBTQ community and their connection with it has sustained, I think, the issue of gun control, which is Gen Z's movement itself has activated them. And we know that in small cities, not necessarily DC or New York City, the protesting is being led by youth. And so I think that will help to sustain it to some extent. But the question becomes, does the media have the attention span to hold on to this issue and to cover? And that's where I'm a lot less optimistic.
So Dean, I got a phone call from someone who's active in a campaign. And she said to me, you know, we've been talking a lot about, look at those people, they're not wearing masks. Look at those people, they're swimming and they're not social distancing. Look at these people. She said, and then I go to a protest. I mean, the good news about Concord, I have to say this, was that virtually everybody was wearing a mask. And to the extent that they could sort of social distance, they did. But I am looking on TV and I'm not seeing. And Val's comment about the pandemic has kind of disappeared. And what I think is frightening is that I think Donald Trump is looking at this and seeing the people on the streets that may in fact be sharing COVID-19 with each other. And in some ways, he sees another benefit. He sees social unrest, and he sees the potential of what COVID does, especially to a significant population that is marching. And I wish I didn't think he was so evil, but I do. And I'm not going to apologize for it. And I think that's another reason why he doesn't want to talk about COVID-19. Because right now, COVID-19 is a vehicle for him, not something he needs to address.
Can I get back to Val's comments about the media? Because, you know, it's a hobby horse of mine for sure, but it really bothers me. Not that Val says it, it's true, but it bothers me that the media says, okay, we're not talking about the coronavirus anymore, we've moved on to the next issue. It's like, you know, what? Don't they have the ability, number one, and the responsibility, number two, decent journalists, to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time? I mean, my goodness, the coronavirus is a problem, and it's systemic racism is an important problem, and social change through protest and elections and all of this together is an important issue. You know, our radio show, Arnie's wonderful, but she isn't the only one in the world that could figure out that you ought to be able to talk about several different issues. And there are many of them that are vitally important. Climate change, too, you know?
How can the media not be responsible? Because he solved the ventilator problem, Dean. Remember when we had a ventilator problem? Well, now we're sending ventilators to Europe and we're sending ventilators to Africa. I mean, in so many ways, it is hard for the media to sort of multitask. And in part, you know this, Dean, we've known this for years. You do too, as all of us do. If it bleeds, it leads. And the problem right now is we've been hearing COVID-19 morning, noon, and night for months, not weeks, but months, Stephen. In comes this horrific murder of George Floyd, which again has, you know, you can't avert your eyes from. And it is galvanized, as Stephen points out, probably the biggest strikes that we've ever seen in protests ever, maybe in US history. And the media is not capable, I think, of creating the quilt of the story, because the story isn't just the protests. It still very much is COVID-19 and all the underlying horrific, not only potential, but what we're seeing, the numbers are increasing around the world. That was one of the articles I posted, was that it's increasing around the world. We're beginning to see cities where the hotspots are growing and they're places that don't have the beds to accommodate them. What is it going to be like 14 days from now? And do I blame the media for not covering it? Or do I just recognize that we just don't have the capacity to hold on to all these stories?
No.
Because it is remarkable, Arnie, watching the, you know, we're all news consumers here and we pay close attention, and it was, you know, it was all impeachment, 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 and then it was all pandemic, pandemic, pandemic. Now it's the focus has shifted to racial injustice. There is a little bit of the pandemic. I mean, it's all interrelated, obviously, given that people of color are disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. Hearing now a discussion, there's a fascinating political debate taking place on social media. Conservatives are arguing, why was it not okay for groups of people to congregate in churches? You know, a couple hundred anti-lockdown protesters to go to state capitals, putting aside the gun-toting aspect of things for a moment. Why were epidemiologists on MSNBC and CNN around the clock saying that that was a recipe for disaster, yet they're willing to sign on to these social justice, these massive protesting where social distancing is just basically impossible. A lot of people are wearing masks, but not everybody's wearing masks. People are shouting, they're chanting. If they're getting gassed, they're coughing. Why is that okay? This is a fascinating debate that has erupted. And you know what sort of epidemiologists who have kind of said that the protesting was okay now have said that, well, it's all interconnected, that social injustice and racism and structural inequality and poverty kills hundreds of thousands of people a year, and the pandemic kind of folds into that. So the reality is, I mean, even the pandemic itself has now become politicized as well.
So the New Yorker had a wonderful story about this demonstration, and the fact is that it's happening in all 50 states, and it's going to have a lot of governors and cities rethinking the reopening of their economy. And they're going to have to rethink it when? In 2 weeks. I mean, that's when the reality is going to hit, Stephen. But as I'm listening to this about why we can't handle many stories at once, why it's got to be all impeachment, why it's got to be all pandemic, why it's got to be all George Floyd, I really do think we need to have a split screen. We need to watch the BBC and the CBC, and then we need to watch MSNBC, CNN, and because you have to teach people how to be able to hold on to more than one thought. And if you look at what the BBC does, the BBC covers what's going on, but it gives you such a gestalt of the world. It isn't all pandemic. It wasn't all George Floyd. It isn't all climate change, but they have literally developed within their audience the creative, curious muscle to be able to hold on to a couple of stories. We have so dumbed us down, Stephen. We have not developed that capacity. And in part, I blame the media. That's how we got Donald Trump. Donald Trump was a freaking ratings god. Donald Trump wasn't a good candidate. He wasn't even a candidate. You know, he was a master manipulator. But who did he manipulate? The media. The mainstream media. Someone has to reevaluate who we are and what we do, Stephen.
I think there's another big piece to this puzzle, and that is the evisceration of local media that has been going on throughout the United States over the course of the last, two decades now. And I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but the sheer number of places that no longer have a local newspaper, that do not have local reporters, right? And part of sort of what we're seeing happen on social media is people trying to step in and fill some of that gap, right? Sort of that live on scene reporting, only it's just sort of random people and their iPhone, and that serves a function. But what you don't have is those local reporters, right, who are at City Hall every day, who know the city budget, who know what's going on, who are able to step in front of the camera or a microphone and say, let me put what's going on with our local police department in a context to help you make sense of it. By hollowing that out, we lose another tool that would allow people to better understand and make sense of the world. And that worries me more. I think the solution to television media is turn off your television. Do not use that for information about politics or policy.
I have a few minutes. Val, as I'm listening, here's the amazing thing. I'm looking at what's wrong with the police union. What's wrong with the police union is that they have done transparency and accountability avoidance. Okay? Well, and they've been very effective. They threaten politicians. They basically use the cut of their muscle. You saw it in Minneapolis, but you see it virtually everywhere. Well, you know how you deal with the idea that they don't like transparency and accountability? Local media.
Absolutely.
What Stephen is saying is
the loss of local media has actually hurt unions too, because they think that they have to avoid transparency, avoid accountability, and at least the local media would step in and expose it, and they would have to deal with it. But as you've seen the local media dissolve, guess what? They've gotten stronger, but actually it's not gotten better.
And studies have shown in the 50 states that as local media has increased, the spending by the state legislature has increased. And they do believe that there's a cause and effect relationship there. That, and again, state legislatures will hold off bills until the very last minute when they're ready to recess. And they run through a flood of spending proposals that often benefit them. And nobody's there to report on it. And so the studies are showing over and over again that when the government is not watched, there really is a deleterious effect.
So I'm going to end, Dean Spiliotis, with, we need to do a show about, let's celebrate watchdogs. Because you know, I'm thinking about what our governor, Chris Sununu, said about people complaining about people not wearing masks or not complying with the rules and regulations. He referred to them as snitches. I think we need to take back that word. No, they're watchdogs. And we used to have media that was a watchdog. And we used to have, I mean, think about what they've done. Even the idea of oversight. I mean, they're not snitches. It's a watchdog. It's oversight. It's what journalists do. It's what you want in government because it's what keeps us honest. Anyway, it's our Rethink the Week. Stephen Pimpare, Val Endres, Dean Spiliotis. We need 4 hours. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and Ken Barnes. It's the Monday edition. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
One day when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day. When the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
glory, glory.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground. The camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran.